Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we are glad to have you all listening. We're also happy to have here once again on the program as our guest, Kevin Wasby. He's a lecturer in finance in the College of Business here at the University of Illinois, and he's here for this program that we have been doing now for a long, long time, once a month on a Friday, to give people an opportunity to ask financial planning questions. We thought, well, this was something that folks would always have questions about, and it would be a good idea to have a regular opportunity to do that. Most of the time, the guy who's here in the chair is Dave Sinnoh. He's been taking a little time off here, and ably filling in for him, Kevin Wasby. Every once in a while, he is here too. Whichever of these guys shows up, we're always happy to have him here, and always happy to have questions from people who are listening. So if you have some specific question, and you can try to be as specific as you can about your own financial situation, we'll call in here and Kevin will give you his best advice. And then you can put that in your big basket of advice when it comes to making your decisions. We would hope you know, don't do it because Dave says to do it or because Kevin says to do it. We want you to think very carefully about your financial planning. But this is one, you know, one sort of piece of advice. You can get his thoughts, and we'd be happy to have the calls. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you, David. It's always good to be here.
Well, I tell you what, we already have a caller, so rather than make this person wait, we'll get right to him. And this caller is in St. Joe on line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
Kevin, I've got questions regarding converting equities to bond funds and converting a CD ladder for emergency fund to a bond fund. And first, my wife and I are in our mid-70s, and we desire higher allocations of bond funds. So in our IRAs at Vanguard, we're considering exchanging equity funds for the short-term and the intermediate-term Treasury shares funds. And we're considering a 70-30 split, like a 70% intermediate term and 30% short-term funds. Just wondered, what do you think about that plan?
It probably makes sense from a point of view. One of the things that you've mentioned is the fact that it's Vanguard funds. They're certainly some of the more cost-efficient mutual funds. And that's an important thing to look for with anyone's investment plans. So I like that aspect of it. The short-term and intermediate-term type of treasuries are certainly very safe from an aspect of default risk. It's still a shaky credit market. I know things have improved very greatly from where they were perhaps 6 or 9 months ago, but it's still very shaky. We both know the downfall of moving money into those funds at this point in time. The first is the obvious, namely, yields, particularly on Treasury bonds right now, are very low. The other one is not so obvious, and that is if interest rates rise with a recovery in the economy, as one would normally expect, you could be seeing a decline in the net asset value of those funds as that occurs. So I like the strategy. I'm not trying to be a market timer. You did mention something, an aspect of a ladder of securities, and perhaps in that, let me go on with a possible suggestion in moving that money from equity funds into those two Treasury funds, and that would be to do it stepwise. Allocate the total amount of money that you intend to move into those funds, and rather than do it with one transaction, spread it out over the next 18 months maybe. And do an 18th of it each month.
Oh, very good. Okay, good. Nice suggestion. Okay, and the other question was, we currently have a CD ladder that constitutes our emergency fund, and the CDs that we have, the rates range from 2.3 to 3.7%. Now, the Vanguard Intermediate Term Treasury Shares Fund consistently generates a higher rate of return and also has a check writing service that's available on the account. So what we're considering is investing the CDs as they mature in the reference bond fund versus purchasing new CDs if their interest rates are lower than the intermediate term treasury fund. What do you think about that plan?
The convenience of having check writing ability on a mutual fund is exactly that, a convenience. I caution people not to need to rely on it. Again, we all know that a mutual fund like the Vanguard Intermediate Treasury Fund is a variable net asset value. Every day, the value of those fund shares change, sometimes very, very slightly, sometimes not so slightly. When you write checks against the fund, you're redeeming shares of the fund. And, you know, be cognizant of the fact that you might be redeeming shares at a value of the fund less than your purchase price.
Okay. Yeah.
The nice thing about a checking account, a savings account, something that you would say is a stable dollar-for-dollar account structure is that for liquidity purposes, there are no surprises. You can get at the money. The money is always a dollar plus whatever meager amount of interest that you earn. I would like to go back and compliment you on the CD ladder with the rates that you mentioned. Given the low rates in today's environment, those are relatively attractive yields. So, again, for emergency funds, surprises are usually negatives. I'm not trying to tell you don't do what you're considering, but I really do like the thought of running a CD ladder and keeping some of the money in a liquid account, whether it's a savings account or checking account. And again, the purpose of that emergency money, if you want to call it that, is to have no surprise.
Yeah. Hmm. So you're more comfortable just leaving it, have a CD ladder for emergency fund versus going to a bond fund?
I am, because worst case scenario is if you need to break out of a CD prior to its maturity, you know that you pay an interest penalty, you know the amount. Even in a situation where a person says, well, I need the money, you will also have an opportunity, and a lot of people don't think of this, but you will have an opportunity to use the CD as collateral against a loan at the bank. Rather than paying the interest penalty, you could always weigh that alternative and see would the cost of the interest on the loan be less than the interest penalty by breaking the CD. Many banks are very accommodating when it comes to setting up a very short-term loan in lieu of breaking a CD prior to its maturity. And again, it's been my experience in the past where a local banker is happy to work with you because they realize that you do have the ability to pull the money out of the CD. You do have to pay the interest penalty. Again, if they're at all customer service oriented, they're happy to keep your business a short-term loan. The CD is collateral against it. The interest penalty or the interest charge on the loan would, in most instances, at least in my experience, be less than the interest penalty. So you've got access. You have no risk of repayment. Obviously, the bank has no risk in the deal. Everybody kind of comes out a winner under the circumstances.
Yeah, very good. Okay, thanks for your thought.
Thank you.
Thank you. This morning here on Focus 580, in this hour of the show, the guest, Kevin Wasby. He's a lecturer in finance in the College of Business at the U of I. And this is a program that we do once a month. It's on a Friday, and we talk about money management and give people the opportunity to call and ask questions. We have a couple here who are ready to go, and let me just give you that number again, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Next caller is up in the Chicago area in Des Plaines, and that's line four. Hello. Mm-hmm.
Ken, I wonder if you have an opinion. This is a real estate question. We have been considering for the past few years a second home in northern Michigan, and with all the trouble going on in the state of Michigan and the general economy being what it is right now, I just wondered, should we continue to sort of review the situation rather than be serious about a commitment this summer, or are we, to the contrary, should we jump in? And just what kind of thoughts do you have about that situation and the horizon on that?
Sure, that's a great question. I have to be, you know, straight up front and tell you that I'd love to be able to say that I could predict a bottom, whether it's in the price of a stock or the price of a house in Michigan or wherever. But, you know, let's be honest, I can't. I would look at it this way. Certainly from, say, 2 to 3 years ago, my guess would be any place that you would look in Michigan for a vacation house, a price today would certainly seem to be a lot less than it was 2 or 3 years ago. So congratulate yourself on having waited that long. How much lower would it be or could it be in the coming 6 months, 12 months, 18 months, whatever? Golly, I don't know. I think this is one of those classic family decisions. Your family is obviously disgusted enough to say you're interested in pursuing it. Probably this stage of the game, if you haven't already done so, maybe some more than cursory review of properties available for sale, asking prices, so on and so forth. You know, take a week-long vacation, visit with realtors in the area, get a sense of how things are working, what prices are doing, how many properties are listed for sale, what kind of amenities you're interested in. Certainly turn up the pressure on your shopping. Pulling the trigger this summer and saying, well, this is the absolute low. Again, I can't say that.
Right.
I don't see anything on the horizon that would tell me that house prices are going to jump next month, within the next 6 months, or for any other particular reason such as that. Michigan, as you mentioned, is a state that at least the lower peninsula, the main body of the state, has certainly been impacted very severely with the decline in manufacturing jobs, whether it's directly autos or somehow in support or related to autos. Again, some of the feelings that I have in terms of the state's economy of Michigan rebounding anytime soon do certainly revolve around that. And again, I don't see anything on the horizon that's imminent to say manufacturing activity is going to jump and, you know, just a level of prosperity is right around the corner. So, again, I'd certainly dial up the emphasis on shopping and educating yourself. I don't know if I'd carry my checkbook with me, but, you know, this is a good time to really learn the market, learn the areas that you think you're interested in, and get a greater sense of availability and costs.
So, I mean, that what you say about real estate is true. You never can tell what's going to happen, what's around the corner. And that general overhang from what's going on and has gone on in Detroit really blurs everything about the state, and it makes one be more hesitant simply because of that was such a driver for so many years, the Detroit industry, which is a shadow of what it used to be. And so you're not quite sure, what's the expression they use with stock about, would I be catching a dagger or something like that? So,
yeah. And you know the basic I think the ingredient in your decision that is something that we haven't discussed that's really fundamental is this and hear me out. What the price is today or on a day that you make a purchase transaction shouldn't have much related to what you feel about in the next 5 to 10 years. I am assuming that whatever you purchase is going to be a comfortable financial fit in your budget, and whether you're paying X number of dollars per month for that second house and it is worth 20% more than you paid for it or 20% less than you paid for it is really irrelevant. So if you're not in the I think I'm going to buy it at the bottom. I think I'm going to experience a 20% appreciation, and I think I'm going to sell it quickly. If that has nothing to do with your motivation in looking for it, then that's got to be the fundamental. That's got to be the foundation that you follow.
Well, I think that's good advice, and I appreciate your time this morning.
All right.
You're welcome.
Thanks for the call. We'll go on here, and next person we'll talk to is back here where we are in Champaign, and the caller's online too. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I wanted to, last month I tried to call in and come to your defense during that firestorm regarding corporate taxation and so on and so forth. And
oh, well, thanks for the thoughts.
I wanted to make the comment, I hope that anybody that was listening then is listening now, as an example, when one pays real estate tax, does somebody named real estate pay that tax, or do you pay that tax? And sales tax, does somebody named sales pay that tax, or do you pay that tax? Milton Friedman long ago pointed out that corporate income taxes are nothing more than income taxes collected by the corporation, and so forth. And I, for one, and what I'd like your comments on, I would like to see a major restructuring of the way our taxation is done in this country, where you have taxes for things such as, you know, the funds to fund the Federal Aviation Administration are borne entirely by people who have airplanes, who fly on airplanes, who ship things on airplanes, and so forth. Real estate taxes would be collected only for things like, you know, local fire and police protection and nothing else. And do away with all sales taxes on items under, say, $500, that kind of thing, and then go to a progressive, fair system of income taxes on the federal, state, county, and local level, which I think would be far more just and far more fair. You know, as an example, I'm sure you would agree that as a proportion of their income, the very poor in this country pay a very greater percentage of their gross income in sales taxes because they have to spend money on things, you know, just ordinary things that, you know, someone who makes $20,000 a year spends a greater percentage of his or her income on than someone who makes $100,000 a year, and so forth. I'm not at all opposed to taxation. I just like to see it more fairly collected and collected once and only once a time a year, except, you know, for fee for service, you know, like taxes on motor fuels to pay for highways and also to discourage their use and things like that. I'm babbling here a bit, but your general thoughts on the notion of restructuring our tax system to make it more fair and equitable and not having the government pick in our pocket every time we basically walk down the street almost, you know, every time we purchase something or go somewhere, there's a tax for this and a tax for that, so on and so forth. And your comments, please. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate the thoughts, and the nice thing about discussion is that we come to resolution. So discussion's good.
We set up this program a long time ago to try and help give people an opportunity to ask really nuts and bolts kind of questions. Yeah, occasionally we do get into this macroeconomic stuff, which maybe leads to interesting discussions, but that's not really what we set up this program to do. So I want to say I thank the comment the caller gave, and we'll just go on here. Let's go to Champaign next in line number three. Hello.
Hi, I have a question from Mr. Shawaski on contributing to Roth IRAs versus paying down principal on a mortgage. My husband and I are both 25, and we recently bought a home. Our interest rate on our mortgage is 5.125%, and we both also have had Roth IRAs for quite a while. Our IRAs had been doing so badly that we were thinking of paying extra on towards our mortgage principal rather than contributing to our IRA, thinking that we'd get a better rate of return on our money. But now that we're actually about to make that contribution, our IRAs are doing a little bit better. I believe they're about 5.75% for the year-to-date returns. And so we were wondering just really what your advice is on what's the best route in our situation.
May I ask, the term of the mortgage, how long is it?
It's 30 years.
Well, 5.125% on a 30-year mortgage is a very cheap cost of money. As a matter of fact, 5 1/8%, you probably have one of the cheaper 30-year mortgages out there that's been put together over the past 50 years. So the side of me that does not like debt would like me to say, oh, pay down on the mortgage. But the side of me that looks at a cost of funds and a use of funds really has me thinking that that's not something that you should be doing.
Okay.
I like the thought of being out of debt. Don't get me wrong. So it's difficult for me to say this. But my bias is to say I think you should be continually funding a retirement vehicle, and a Roth IRA is a very good vehicle to be able to do that. If it's an easy way to think about it, and I know that this is not all-encompassing, but let me take the logic this way. If you put money into a Roth IRA account and, you know, all things fail, everything works against your financial situation, and you really get into a bind, you can still access the money. I know there's tax implications. Hopefully it wouldn't be before 5 years. There's still the 10% excise tax before age 59 and a half. I know that it's not pain-free, but it's still accessible. On the other hand, if you get into a bind, you cannot go back to your mortgage company or your bank and say, well, I'd really like to have that extra principal I paid back.
Okay.
They laugh at you. See? Because once you pay the principal on the mortgage, the loan is retired in that amount. You don't pull it back out. Okay? So a mortgage is a one-way street. You pay the minimum each month. You can always pay more than the minimum. Heck, you can pay it off entirely. But with 5 1/8% cost of money for 30 years, and the fact that it's a tax-subsidized cost of money, it's a little bit like saying, well, you know, I'm going to take those items back to the store that I bought at 50-year low prices.
Okay.
So I'd say stick with the IRA funding. We all know that markets are volatile. Rather than making once-a-year contribution to an IRA, if it helps in your budgeting and helps in a dollar cost averaging process, consider making monthly contributions to your IRA. At least you're spreading out the purchase cost of whatever assets in that IRA you're putting money into.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your advice.
All right.
You're welcome.
We're midway through this hour of Focus 580. My name is David Inge, and our guest this morning, Kevin Wasby, he's a lecturer in finance in the College of Business at the U of I. This is a program that we do once a month on a Friday to give people an opportunity to ask investing and money management questions. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I was thinking, going back to, I think actually it was the first caller started me thinking about when you invest in mutual funds and you look at where it is you want to put your money, there are a lot of different kinds of things you can put your money into. But I think probably most people think in terms of the two biggest chunks are probably going to be stocks and bonds, and that they are going to be attractive. You know, stocks are attractive because there's maybe better growth potential, but there is risk. And bonds, I think we have this idea that, well, bonds are a little bit more stable. They're not quite so volatile. Depending on where you are and how much risk you want to take, well, you're going to decide how much money you want to put into each one of those things. And some people are really aggressive and they say, oh, you ought to be 60, 70, 80% in stocks. And other people, that makes them feel uncomfortable. Is that actually the function of bonds in your portfolio? Was that thinking about it correctly? And are there other things that might give you that kind of stability aside from bonds?
Yeah, good question. It gets back to a fundamental, the D word, diversification. So your mom told you, my mom told me, most mothers told their kids at some point in their lives, don't put all your eggs in one basket. And that's what finance talks about basically when we use the word diversification. What we're trying to find is assets or classes of assets whose movements are not correlated. So in other words, if something's doing well, that other thing may not be doing as well. If the original thing starts doing poorly, then hopefully that other thing won't be doing poorly. So it's not a sense of a hedge. If we were literally talking about hedging, then we'd try to design two things that moved exactly opposite from one another. We'd try to hedge, meaning we try to lock a price in. Diversification is not hedging. Diversification is finding things that are just less than perfectly correlated with each other in their movements. Classically or typically, bonds and stocks are uncorrelated in their movements over time. Here's what I mean. Generally speaking, a stock market will rise to reflect a growing prospect of an economy. Stock value should reflect the value of the corporate entities, prospects and profits. As the economy grows, their profits grow, the stock prices rise. However, generally speaking, when the economy grows, interest rates rise because the demand for money rises with a higher activity in the economy. When you look at a bond, you have to remember that once a bond is purchased, that bond has a value whose value varies inversely with the level of interest rates. Once I buy a bond that has a fixed rate of interest, the value of the bond falls if interest rates in the economy rise. So when you see that countercyclical move, when the economy is expanding, when stock values are rising, you might see a deterioration in the value of the bonds you own. The reverse happens when the economy slows. When the economy slows, interest rates fall, the demand for money is less. Sometimes the federal government forces short-term interest rates very low, as they're currently doing and have been doing for a year and a half. That tends to make the value of bonds rise, which hopefully offsets the value of the falling stocks. So you do get, again, that kind of counter-cyclical move when you think about the two most obvious asset classes, stocks and bonds.
Okay. Well, the one other thing that has to do with this sort of balancing and the idea that when one thing goes up, the other thing goes down. On the stock side, I think for a long time people said, well, what you ought to do is in your stock portfolio have some sort of mix of U.S. companies and foreign companies. And there the idea was, okay, it tends to be when the economy of the U.S. is up, maybe the other economies are not doing quite as well, and the other way around. Then we got to the point where I think some people were saying, well, you know what, that doesn't quite work anymore. There's not that much difference. The economies are too closely linked. But then we also do have, if you want to invest outside the United States, we do have things like emerging markets funds where it ought to be maybe a little bit different. Is that in fact the case that there is going to be maybe some sort of a difference, or maybe just you would hope some greater growth potential looking at something like that as opposed to investing in say big foreign companies, but big foreign companies that are located in other industrial nations?
You've hit on two important elements of bringing the issue of diversification across borders. The first is the notion that the world's economies are not perfectly linked. That's still true, but I think we've probably proven that the economies of developed nations are probably more linked than anyone suspected. So, again, the thought of diversifying outside of the United States, if you're a U.S. citizen, is a good idea. 20 years ago, 10 years ago, even 5 years ago, the benefits thought to be gotten by doing that, I think in the past 2 years, have been a little disproved. Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, what's gone on in the past couple of years has certainly been breathtaking. It's also been precedent-setting. It's been compared to things that haven't happened for 40 years or perhaps even 80 years. But what I'm saying is there is still an element of diversification when you move money into international markets. The second point that you bring up is a good one, too, in that there are international markets that are developed, then there are those emerging markets. Generally speaking, I'd say the emerging market aspects of investing money would go to the high growth potentials. So in other words, you're taking on a higher level of risk rather than looking at a diversifying overall impact of lowering risk when you really think about emerging markets. That's why emerging market investments in a complete portfolio would probably be one of the smallest components of the total.
Okay. We have a caller here to get in, and we'll go next and talk with someone in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I just actually started listening a little while ago, but I do have a question about combining accounts, retirement accounts. I'm pretty much with TIAA CREF, and I've got another account with Fidelity, and they're all retirement types of instruments. And I've have one from a previous institution, one here, and I'm probably going to be leaving this one and going to another one in about a year or two. Is it better to combine all of them into one? I've talked to a couple of people that say they do rollovers into like one kind of instrument, or you've been talking about diversification. Do I just leave them in these separate places instead of trying to combine everything?
This is going to be kind of a generic answer, and
okay.
I'll base it on some assumptions, and then let me come back and tell you what those assumptions are, okay?
Okay.
Generally speaking, I would say that with names such as the names you used, I would be in favor of combining.
Okay.
And the reason is basically bookkeeping, simplifying your life, if you want to call it that. Having money in basically duplicate plans in different places with perhaps different implications, it certainly doesn't simplify your life. And God forbid somebody else would have to pick up the pieces in the event you couldn't do it. It obviously doesn't simplify things for them.
Right, okay.
So as part of an overall planning and management aspect, that kind of tempts me into saying, in a general sense, I'd like to see things more combined, more centralized. Now, here are the assumptions. The assumptions are the money in something like TIAA CREF is not subject to surrender penalties or, how should we say, early withdrawal surrender charges. TIAA CREF is a big, complex organization. They offer retirement plan services through a lot of different not-for-profits and educational institutions, as we both know. They offer them, however, in a lot of different ways. Some are annuities. Some are, for the lack of a better term, a mutual fund type of an account. You know, so here comes my it depends. If you look at moving money out of TIAA's 403B plan into a 403B plan managed by Fidelity, and you face surrender charges to do so, then it's probably not perhaps a wise idea to do it this time. You got to examine and see when the surrender charges go away and all of that type of thing.
Yeah.
When you take an entity like Fidelity or perhaps even a Vanguard as a better example, and consolidate through the process of a rollover retirement monies that are coming out of a 403B, the other thing that you want to make sure that you do is this. 403B money can be rolled out of that type of plan into a rollover IRA account.
Right. That's what I had heard in IRA.
But the thing that you need to be cautious about is you may be losing some of the benefits ascribed to a 403B plan and the participants in it that are not available and have never been available to an IRA account. So that's, again, something to consider.
Okay.
Now, another thing that I don't mean to belabor the point here, but another avenue to look at rather than a rollover to an IRA is a direct asset transfer from one 403B plan to another. So you mentioned you may be leaving here, you may be going to another university perhaps, you may be an active participant in their 403B plan. You sit down and, you know, if you find that to be the case, sit down with all of your statements and the benefit advisor at that institution and you say, is there a way for me to combine all of these 403B plan assets into this current 403B? And if the answer is yes, well, you see, the money never leaves the status of a 403B plan. And if you're happy with who that institution uses as their custodian, trustee, and investment purveyor, you know, again, it might be TIAA, it might be Fidelity, it might be Vanguard. If you're happy with the investment opportunities they provide and the charges that are entailed there, well, then you've got it basically in one place where you can manage it. It's still in the status of a 403B, and it's in a cost-efficient mechanism to manage the investment side of it.
Okay, so take a look at that. The only kind of follow-up is that you mentioned annuity. At the previous institution, I did have a percentage of that plan be in an annuity with TIAA CREF. So it's, I guess, a TI, not the CREF,
yeah.
However they split it up.
Yeah.
But so that's just one portion. There's another portion that is the 403B. So it is a little more complicated because I know there are problems with taking the money out of the annuity, not so much with the mutual fund kind of aspect of it.
Right, and that's the part where I would say be very cautious. I'll remind you also that if it's a fixed annuity, if it's the old traditional component of TIAA,
yep.
that was the original fixed annuity thing, you know, there's in some. Some people are really down on annuities. I like to look at them as still something that might have a fit in a person's financial plan. And the one thing that you can't take away from a fixed annuity is this. The insurance company guarantees to pay you X number of dollars and cents per month as long as you live.
Right.
And, you know, there's no other investment vehicle that does that outside of a fixed annuity. So before a person... you know, says, well, I'm going to surrender that old part of the annuity plan and get rid of it and move the money over here. Think of it as a component in the whole of your financial plan.
Okay.
Especially if it involves things like surrender charges.
Okay. So that might actually still be something that would work within the portfolio of everything that I've got.
Absolutely.
Okay. Cool. All right. Great. Well, thanks for your help.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Kevin Waspy is our guest. He's a lecturer in the College of Business and Finance here at U of I. And this is our monthly show on money management, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I got a question here that's coming off air, and actually, interestingly enough, it has to do with annuities. And we have someone who says, well, I've got some money that I consider part of my retirement savings, and my bank, when asked, well, what would it be good to do with this, their suggestion was annuity. And the things that seem to be attractive are, one, they guarantee the principal, and the other is that the earnings, whatever it earns, this is tax deferred. And those two seem like, well, pretty good features, and was interested in getting some more of your thoughts about annuities.
Annuities are very specific. A fixed annuity is a very specific component that might make sense in some people's financial plan. I'm not a great fan of selling new annuities. Generally speaking, the annuities have rather high fixed but hidden commissions. So in a sales world, there's an old saying in the insurance business, annuities are not purchased, they're sold. Think about that for a minute.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Now, I don't mean to defame anyone who's made the suggestion. I don't mean it at all to impugn the reason they've made the suggestion. If anybody wants to crawl down my throat and say that I'm, you know, trying to say that the person making the suggestion is a charlatan only out to earn the commission, that's just patently wrong. But I do need to know, and I do saying something that makes no sense, I do need to know the motivation behind why that person was recommended a fixed annuity. If it's something that makes sense in light of everything else in their financial plan, that's a great reason. If it is a cost-effective fixed annuity, if it doesn't have a very high commission up front, that makes sense. If it has generous, policy provisions, because let's face it, an annuity is an insurance policy. And then finally, if it is issued by a company that you would say is a safe insurance company, because God knows we've discovered just because it's an insurance company doesn't mean that they're flawless. If all of those things fit, then there might be a very, very good reason for that money to go into a fixed annuity. But I will say again, annuities are sold, not purchased. They're relatively easy to sell a consumer from the notion of saying, here, this is guaranteed, it's safe, end of story, sign here. Caution with financial decisions is always a good thing to have.
So, the alternative would be, anybody can go to one of the big mutual fund companies and open an account and put together themselves a portfolio and then put the money into that. But should one be put off by the idea that, well, yeah, whatever you earn, you're going to get a 1099 or whatever it is at the end of the year, and then you're going to have to report that earnings and you're going to have to pay tax on it.
Right. Again, all of the aspect of investments, the type of vehicles that we end up with the money flowing into, the retirement planning aspect, insurance, mutual funds, the hybrids like annuities, variable annuities work like an insurance contract because they are an insurance contract that have a mutual fund attached to them. So the value of the annuity goes up and down with the value of the subcontract that you've basically invested the money through. Bottom line is this. If people don't want to take the, self-healing approach, there's, fee-for-service financial planners do good work. And, fee-for-service planners who do good work really have no bias in directing people to go to a one type of a product over another. So I think if a person looks at it that way and says, I can always get someone's opinion. It won't cost me an arm and a leg to set up a meeting with a fee-for-service planner and get what I hope is an unbiased approach to looking at what I might pursue.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, we certainly have time for some other questions here. Someone wants to give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, just one other thing. Again, this is something that I made a note of mentioning going back to the beginning. Now there are lots and lots of mutual funds that people can invest in that have no sales load. So that's kind of like a no-brainer, no-load fund. But that doesn't mean there aren't costs associated with being in those funds. Is there anything in particular that when you're reviewing your basics of those funds that right away you should say, well, look at this number, just as you're deciding, do I like this fund?
Yeah, the easiest thing to look at with any mutual fund is what's referred to as the expense ratio. And that's pretty much an all-encompassing cost of having the money invested in that pool. It's a way of looking at it and saying, well, if the fund earned 5% on their investment performance, subtract that expense ratio from it, and that, as an investor, is what I would receive. Expense ratios literally run from, tenths of percentages, so basis points, 1/100 of 1%. Very cost-efficient mutual funds, predominantly things in the Vanguard index category, may run expense ratio as low as 14, 15 basis points. Managed mutual funds of stocks can run 1.5%, 2%. That's 200 basis points. So, yeah, a little shopping like that will save you a long-term expense. And again, these are all no-load funds, so there's no commission at time of purchase. There's no surrender charge at time of sale. But again, it's the annual ongoing management fees, costs of statement stuffers and all of the junk mail that you get and so on and so forth. It pays a little bit to do some shopping.
We have a couple of other callers now. Let's go first to Urbana Line 1. Hello. Yes.
Okay. How would a clueless person with nothing but yellow pages identify a fee-for-service planner?
I would look under financial planning.
Under financial planning. Okay.
But I'm really poor. I mean, my experience in using the yellow pages is really bad. It takes me about 3 guesses before I finally find what I want.
Okay. I'll try it. Thanks.
All right. Thank you. And then I'm assuming that when you make the call, that's the first thing you say. So let's say, look, I'm looking for a fee-for-service planner. Is that what you do? And I guess
great
either
question.
They say yes or no. And if they say no, you say, well, thank you very much. And then you go on.
Great question.
All right. Cell phone caller here in Champaign, line 2. Hello.
Yes. Hello.
Yes.
Yeah,
go ahead.
So I have 2 questions. The first concerns annuities and what you were saying about them. And the question really is if you are going to go shopping for a fixed annuity, what are the questions that you want to ask the salesperson? So that's the first question. The other question has to do with CSRS. I'm a university professor, not too far from retirement, and I'm curious as to how you feel about the security of CSRS in the long run. So I'm going to hang up and listen to you on the radio. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Let me take question number 2 first. I'm a participant in CSRS as well. I elected the traditional plan, which is, the fixed annuity payments, survivor benefits for my wife, so on and so forth. So I guess I'm as plain vanilla as you can get in CSRS. And as far as I'm, my feelings about the plain vanilla election in CSRS that I've made is, I think it's great. I don't fear for it. I'm not worried that it's going to go away. And I, quite frankly, as a university employee, I couldn't imagine a better choice that I could have made. So I'm happy with it. Back to the first question, when talking with an insurance person, considering annuities, fixed annuities, some of the questions you ask are some of the questions that we ask whether we're talking about annuities or mutual funds, and that is, what does this cost me? So, in other words, tell me, up front, I'm not trying to beat you out of a living, but do you make an 8% front end commission on this? Do you make a 5%? Do you make a 4%? Numbers in that type of category are pretty common, as high as 8, perhaps as low as 4. Why are you recommending this particular annuity? That's the greatest question I think you can ask the person across the desk. If their answer is, well, this is the annuity I have for myself, that's better than saying, well, because. So, it's a little bit like what's good for the goose is good for the gander. The other thing, obviously, is you want to do a little Google search, if you will, and find out some of the reputation of the insurance company that stands behind that annuity. Now, insurance companies are a myriad of names, so you might have to wade through 3 or 4 different levels of names of the company that would be on the contract in front of you to see actually the insurance company that stands behind it. But that, again, the Internet's a wonderful thing. Doing research and finding credible sources has never been easier. But those are the 3 things that I would do. I would ask the salesman what it costs you, the buyer of the product. The second question I would ask is, why have you recommended this particular product, hoping that the answer is because that's what they bought themselves? And then thirdly, do a little independent search and see what the reputation and rating of the insurance company is that backs it.
Okay. Well, we have time maybe for one more at least. Tolona, line 1. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
On talking about annuities, you're saying they're like an insurance policy. Now, which is going to be a safer policy, a fixed annuity or a variable annuity? I have heard that if the company itself goes bankrupt or is in financial trouble, that a fixed annuity, at least you get your principal back. But if it's a variable annuity, you don't. But then on another talk show, I heard that it was just the opposite. What is your opinion?
Well, an annuity is an insurance contract. Period. End of story. Stop there. Now, we can split that annuity into one or two very different broad categories. A fixed annuity is how many dollars and cents per month at time of annuitizing the contract, meaning beginning distribution. How many dollars and cents per month or per quarter or per year the insurance company promises to pay you as long as you live. That's called a life certain annuity. A variable annuity does not have that promise attached to it because rather than the insurance company guaranteeing a rate of return that's fixed and therefore being able to guarantee a number of dollars and cents per month, per quarter, per year, however the distribution is made, the guarantee falls on your shoulder. And here's what I mean. A variable annuity has you choose which investment vehicle the money goes into. And now the risk of a rate of return is on your shoulders, not the insurance company's shoulders. Whatever rate of return that sub-account earns makes the annuity value grow. The higher it grows, the greater the potential payout in the annuity stage, in the payment stage. So it's like a mutual fund attached to an insurance contract. The annuity contract still has the tax provisions of the fixed annuity. Excuse me. So the buildup in the value of the account is still tax deferred. When you annuitize it and it begins to come out, you pay taxes on the growth, so on and so forth.
I'm sorry to jump in here, Kevin. We just got to quit because we're here at the end of the time. Kevin Wasby is a lecturer in finance here at the U of I. This is our monthly show on money management. We got to go. Thanks very much.
Thank you.